right, welcome to this week's episode of Double A Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
That's right. It's just at the close today, April 5th. I like how you threw in 2024 in it, just so everyone knows. Looks like March Madness is going to conclude on Monday in April, after the Final Four games on Saturday. So that's an exciting time there. This weekend or Saturday's games are, looks like the lines are about 10-point spreads there, so maybe those won't be very close. But the final on Monday, assuming that those two teams win, should be a pretty nice and competitive game.
Well, I won't be checking it out, but I think you will. So just let me know next week how everything goes.
I'll be on a plane, so depending on if the plane has TV or not, well, that's how I'll know.
All right, we'll save it for next week. We'll keep everyone in suspense then.
All right, why don't we get into the where are we for the week?
All right, so taking a look across the board here is a pretty tough week for your traditional asset classes with both stocks and bonds down. But starting out with the S&P 500, week to date, that's down 90 basis points, which also happens to be the month to date and the quarter date, given where we began here. On a year-to-date basis, the S&P still is up 9.5%, led by energy, which is up just under 18% on the year-to-date basis. Comm services is up 14%. That's the number two in the rankings there on the year-to-date basis. But looking at it from the week-to-date basis, those are also number one and two, respectively, with energy up just under 4% for this week, and comm services up 110 basis points. The remaining nine sectors of the S&P 500 were in the red this week, with looks like healthcare, real estate, both down about 3% on the week to date. Consumer discretionary number, the third worst, down 2.8%. So pretty dismal week for most of the underlying sectors of the S&P 500, rolling up into a negative week for the S&P 500 in aggregate. Moving over to fixed income, a little bit of the same here. We have the two-year Treasury note closing the week at a yield of 4.74. That's 12 basis points higher in yield than where it closed last Thursday. The 10-year Treasury note is closed with a yield of 4.4, up 20 basis points, and the 30-year bond ended the week at a yield of 4.55, 21 basis points higher. And looking at it from the year-to-date perspective, pretty much across the board, each one of those tenors are up about 50 basis points in yield over where they ended the year in 2023. So what that meant for the fixed income market, as measured by the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, that was down about a point on the week-to-date basis, bringing the year-to-date return to a negative 1.7%. Across the board, to start out the week, to close the week, and on the month, and to start the month to date and quarter to date basis, we saw red across each one of the cohorts that we typically cover, with the traditional sectors that underlie the ag having the worst performance for this period, with looks like IG corporate credit down the most, down 1.4%, U.S. Treasuries down 1.2%, and agency MBS down 1.1%, while faring relatively better. The more credit-y type of sectors outperformed, but the best performer there was emerging market sovereign debt, down about 6 basis points for the week, bank loans down a quarter point, and then high yield down 2/3 of a point there for this week ending April 5th, 2024. Moving over to commodities is pretty much the only bright light here, with a positive return of 3.5% as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index. On a year-to-date basis, that brings it up to a positive return of 5.8%. Looking at some of the individual futures contracts here on WTI crude oil front month future, the one barrel of WTI crude oil ended up this Friday closing at a price of $86.70. That's up over 4% over the previous week, putting the front month price up 21% on the year-to-date basis. Gold closing above 2,300 this week, up almost 5%, with a close on 1 troy ounce of front month gold futures at $2,323 a troy ounce, and that puts it up 12% positive on the year-to-date basis. And then looking across the underlying complex with regards to the various underlying sectors, also seeing a clean sweep there with precious metals and industrial metals both leading the way, both up about 6% for this week here, and then energy up 4%, eggs up half a point, and then livestock just barely in the positive territory. But given what we saw across some of the more traditional assets, it's worth pointing out they did come out with a positive 9 basis points here on the week-to-date basis. Only thing in the red for the commodity complex is the agricultural sector there. That's down about 2.5% for the year-to-date. Everything else is in positive territory. Precious metals doing quite well, up 13% year-to-date. Livestock doing well, up 11%, and energy complex up 9% on the year-to-date basis. So at least, on this look, as we like to say, Jeff, commodities kind of doing their things, diversifying out from your more traditional assets in terms of the returns on this week-to-date positive performance in this otherwise sea of red.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear, because I hadn't really looked at it, that energy was up. Energy stocks, let's say, were up 18% on a year-to-date basis. That was kind of surprising to me. But then you see the energy commodities up, nine and change. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I actually had to do a double take on that as well, and just confirmed that number earlier today. So it is nice. It is interesting to see energy bouncing back quite strongly again.
All right, with that, let's move on to macro. And since we did our podcast last week on Thursday, and there was some data there coming out on Good Friday, we did promise that we would highlight that data. So last Friday, we did get personal income that was up 0.3% versus a 0.4% expectation. Spending up a surprising 0.8% versus a 0.5% expectation. So people are continuing to spend there. And then the Fed got their inflation numbers, or the preferred inflation numbers out. The PCE month over month number came in at 0.3%. Was expected to be 0.4, so that was good. It came in a little bit under that expectation, and flat versus the prior month. That brought the year over year PCE to 2.5%. And now we look at the core. So core PCE month over month came in at 0.3, right on as expectations, and decreased slightly from the 0.4% last month. That brought the core PCE year over year at 2.8%, flat versus both expectations and the prior month. So as usual, PCE, because we all know all the different components, we know the weightings, comes in right on the screws. Then on Monday, we did get ISM manufacturing. That number surprised to the upside. It was expected to be a 48.3 and came in at a positive or expansionary 50.3. It's the first time that in 16 months that we've been above a 50 print. I guess we were at a 50 back in October 2022. So since October 2022, this is the first time we've been above 50. That actually kind of moved markets, or moved the bond market pretty good there on Monday, with the 10-year Treasury up like 11 basis points on Monday on the back of that stronger manufacturing number. But we did get the JOLTS job openings number that came in at higher than estimates. Slightly higher than estimates at 8.75 million versus 8.73 estimate. Nothing really to see there. The prior number was revised down slightly by like 115,000, but the number seems to be pretty stable there in terms of the job openings. The quits rate was unchanged also, so pretty steady as she goes. We did get the ISM services number on Wednesday. That was a little bit disappointing there, 51.4. Versus a 52.8 expectations. Still expansionary, but definitely looking at something. Maybe we're getting to more of a rebalancing between the services and manufacturing side of things, with both of them, at least both of them now are an expansion. But how this plays out remains to be seen. One of the things that was kind of interesting in that the services one, I'm trying to find the number here in my notes, is that. Oh, the prices paid was at 53.4. So this is the it's the lowest we've seen since March of 2020, but still a pretty high level there. Then on Thursday, we did get the jobless claims numbers. Initial claims came in at 221,000, just slightly 7,000 more than expectations. Continuing claims came in at 1.79 million. Was expected to be 1.81. So again, slightly below expectations there. Steady as she drifts, really continuing these numbers as we've seen, with not much change there. And then this morning on Pizza Friday, we did get the change in non-farm payrolls. That number was estimated to be 214,000. And as is has been happening recently, well above expectations there for the first number, for the first print here, 303,000. So well above expectations. The unemployment rate actually fell, went from 3.9 to 3.8. If you kind of look at the details, though, actually went from 3.86, which rounded up to 3.9, to 3.83, which rounds down to 3.8. So really, it's pretty much unchanged in terms of if you kind of go down to two decimal places there. But, you know, people were worried that that number was going to continue rising because it did bump up to that 3.9 last month. Labor force participation actually came in up 0.2% to 62.7. That was actually stronger than expectations. And your underemployment rate came in at 7.3% flat versus the prior month. I don't know, Sam, if you had anything you wanted to comment on the macro side of things, but seems like the economy, jobs holding in, economy's continuing to be strong, and we'll kind of see how the Fed interprets all of this data.
Yeah, definitely came in much stronger than expected, you know, across the board here. So, I mean, we'll have to see and check out the Fed speak, which seems to be, you know, hitting from different directions, you know, depending on who you're listening to, but it's good to see that perhaps there's some disagreement amongst the members there, but it's just a continuation of some of the themes that we saw in, you know, the March numbers as they were reported, with information coming in stronger than expected to the good side from an economic data standpoint. So it's interesting to see right now, I mean, because based on some of this Fed rhetoric that we've had in the months, you know, the first 3 months, let's just say, of 2024, and then, you know, in, you know, maybe since November or December of 2023, at least from Jerome Powell's seat, it sounded like, you know, he and, you know, many of the members wanted to cut rates going into 2024. But I guess the problem now is just checking out how this incoming data, if it continues to kind of beat expectations to the positive side for the economy, and how that impacts their decision making, or at least their forward looking guidance as they come out and, you know, continue to you know, work their way around the talking head channels.
Yeah, I mean, we did get a lot of Fed speak this week, and nothing really was surprising. A lot of people were talking about Cash Carey and how he's a super hawkish now, and, you know, he was thinking that we need to get inflation moving more towards 2% before needing to do any cuts at all. But then you kind of look, and he's not a voting member, so, you know, has input and talks about it, but doesn't get a vote there. And then obviously Jay Powell is obviously the big one that everyone looks to, and you know, if you're kind of weighting things, I think, what did we determine? Like 80% of you take, if you combine all the Fed speak, you would weight Powell's like 80%, and everybody combined is 20%. And Powell did speak, I believe yesterday, maybe it was Wednesday. And he did say, you know, it's too soon to say if the recent inflation data, this came out after the PCE data. So too soon to see if the recent inflation data was more than a bump. He's, you know, same thing where he doesn't expect interest rate cuts until more confidence on inflation, and that the Fed has time to let incoming data guide his decisions. And so we'll talk about next week here when we come after the topic of the week. But we do get CPI, so that's going to be a very important day there for the Fed and kind of what their path forward is. If you do look at the interest rate probabilities, moved pretty good today on the back of the payroll numbers. And the we're now looking at a 5 or 6% chance of a Fed cut at the next meeting, which is May 1st. Obviously, this could change very easily based upon what happens on CPI. And then we get to a 50% or 54% chance of a Fed cut on June 12th. So this used to be pretty close to like almost 100% probability of a Fed cut. So that's down to about 50-50 there. We are up to a 94% probability for the July 31st meeting there. And then kind of rounded out, you get like 2.5 cuts before the end of the year. So the market's expectations for Fed cuts has continued to diminish. Actually, it's surprising to see the market inside of where the Fed was, you know, a month ago when the Fed was, or I guess it was like 3 weeks ago when the Fed put out their dots and they were saying 3 cuts. Market's at 2.5 now. So pretty significant move there from the 6 or 7 we were getting earlier this year.
Yeah, and we'll continue to guess along alongside the markets as this economic data comes out, and just try to decipher some of these tea leaves for our listeners here.
Yeah, and that is the, I guess, what happens when the market's data or the Fed's data dependent. They're not just going on a course. And so now we're at the cuspy period where we're trying to kind of interpret, and everyone's trying to interpret the data and look at the different upsides and downsides. And, you know, it's typical, as we like to say, with all this data point, you can parse it and look into it in different ways. And, you know, if you're a bull or a bear in terms of, you know, you wanted cuts or your economic perspective, there's always ways to look at it that can kind of fit your narrative.
That's right. It'll be interesting to see if that narrative changes as they continue to, you know, try to rationalize a cut if the economic data continues to be resilient to strong as it has, you know, especially with the inflation data. So I guess we just have to keep waiting for, what is it, maybe 3.5 weeks before the next meeting, which I believe is on May 1st here.
That's right.
I'm correct. Yeah, May 1st. So, all right. With that roundup of the macro and markets, let's jump into our topic of the week. And this week we did get a question from a listener via the X. And the question here was, how does the current TGA balance affect your outlook on duration offerings in Q2 of 2024? So we thought we'd tackle this in this episode. That question actually came in while we were talking last week. So it's interesting. This is nice to see those come in as listeners are following us here live on the spaces. But starting out here, the TGA balance and what's being referenced there is the TGA is an acronym for the Treasury General Account, which is an account that's maintained by the U.S. Treasury at the Federal Reserve, and specifically within the Federal Reserve Banks. It's the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that holds on to this Treasury General Account, or the TGA. And most of us, you know, in the industry, we think of it as basically the checking account for the U.S. Treasury, because the Treasury uses that account to make all of its official payments. And it's also where it receives its deposits. And as we round out the corner here, we're 10 days away from tax days. One of the biggest deposit generation or revenue generator in the form of deposits there comes from tax receipts. But overall, the TGA, it serves as the one consolidated account for all of the government's cash balances. So as I mentioned, your typical deposits that go into this checking account for the Treasury is tax receipts, both from individuals as well as businesses. But you also receive the net proceeds from from the auction of U.S. Treasury securities that kind of are netted out against maturities as they come due. But also, when we think about it from monetary policy perspective, it could also come from the sales by the Federal Reserve from its balance sheet in order to implement the current monetary policy. And then finally, somewhat interesting is money that's seized by law enforcement agencies, federal law enforcement agencies, also fall into the TGA there. In terms of payments, the disbursements there can include government payments to individuals or businesses, also to finance other government operations, and also to pay off maturing debt, as I alluded to before. Also, I suppose, in terms of thinking about it around this tax day holiday, sometimes when the folks who are anticipating to receive a reimbursement from the Treasury or from the IRS, rather, in terms of taxes, a number of those individuals like to, you know, of course, file for their taxes in advance of the April 15th day. So sometimes in the past, you've seen a decline in the TGA as the Treasury is funding out some of those tax reimbursements. I'm not sure. What's the right word on that? I can't remember.
There was a refund.
Refund. Yes. Yeah, I haven't seen one in a while. So
you also called it a holiday. And I think you and I have different definitions of what
definitions of tax days. Yeah, I suppose holiday is the wrong term there for you and I, at least for you and me here. But yeah, you would see the TGA sometimes declining in advance of the, you know, April 15th deadline there, as individuals who are more likely to receive a refund are probably more also likely to file for the taxes in advance. And then after the April 15th deadline, you tend to see the TGA balance start to shoot back up. So we'll watch for it in this coming tax holiday, I got the holiday word stuck in my mind again, but the tax deadline here. But Deutsche Bank did put out this report. I believe it was just a week or so ago, talking about how, on average, around the time of post April 15th, in the 3 day period after that, since the pandemic, the average increase to the TGA has been around $200 billion, going from 2020 to 2023. Looking at that average, part of that is what they have described as increased wages, rising wages, and then also an increases in capital gains, as in particular the S&P 500 largely has had very stellar years in the post-pandemic world outside of 2022. So we'll see if this kind of $200 billion average since 2020 holds for 2024 in terms of where it would place the current balance of the TGA there. But currently the TGA is sitting at just under $770 billion. To provide some context around that number here, we saw a high of 1.8 trillion in the TGA post-pandemic in July of 2020 was a month of that high, but that largely came as a result of the double barrel monetary and fiscal stimulus that we saw in response to the pandemic, because one other source of deposits into the TGA can come from emergency funds that are provided by the administration or that come through let's just say fiscal stimulus policies that we saw back in the pandemic. Some of the CARES Act, things like that go into the TGA, but effectively those emergency funds are allocated and held in that TGA during these crises or emergencies. To help facilitate the federal response there. So that's why we saw in July of 2020, kind of reaching that high of 1.8 trillion there. If we take a look at the time post-pandemic, the lows around this, the most recent low was around 45 billion. People who have listened to this podcast will recall Jeff and I talking about the TGA balance tends to kind of hit those lows as we go into the debt ceiling debates, deadlines, debacles, whatever you want to call it, as the Treasury is no longer as their ability to issue new debt is reduced as we approach those debt ceilings. So the last time it happened, the last two times was right around the most two recent debt ceiling debacles that we had, and that resulted in a low of 45 billion. If you put more context around this, if we take a look at the period from, let's just call it the end of the GFC to the beginning of the pandemic to be, let's put it as kind of around 2008 to 2019, the average around that time was 150 billion for the TGA. But as I mentioned earlier, we're currently sitting at 770 billion. So we've definitely seen a sharp increase in the overall balance of the TGA since that time. Prior to this, prior to the pandemic, the high had only been four, or I say only, but it had been $430 billion again. So hopefully that puts a little bit of context around this idea of TGAs. But Jeff, I know you've done some looking into in terms of how one could think about in terms of fixed income offerings just around duration as a whole, based on what we're seeing here in the TGA.
Yeah, I think a couple things to think about here is that, and I think why the listener brought up the question is last week we were talking about the reverse repo facility, the balance there, and it was at 594 billion or so on March 28th, and we're down to 438 billion as of today. So maybe that little aberration, that increase there was increased for quarter end, as people like to do some window dressing. But the two things with the between the reverse repo and the TGA is that's money, so-called outside of the financial system. So it's not money that's being spent, and it's not money that is being used to kind of transact and use the money multiplier on that money. It just sits there. And so I think that's kind of what drove that question. And one thing to think about is, that's money that's not really working, right? And obviously the TGA. Because if it's 700 billion now, we're getting another couple hundred billion around tax day. We're going to be up at $1 trillion. Then the government will be spending that money, and so then it'll get put to work. But as it sits in the TGA, it's not really working. So one thing to think about and kind of how I was thinking about this is that because the TGA balance is very high, that we're less likely to get, you know, everything else being equal, less likely to have more issuance of treasuries or you know, have that $1 billion sitting in there in the account. They're going to have to issue $1 billion less, the treasury, but have to issue $1 billion less than if the account was at zero. And so from that perspective, I think that, you know, less supply of treasuries should obviously lead to lower rates overall, you know, everything else being equal. And so I think that from kind of just, you know, thinking about it from that perspective, I think that it's more likely that you're going to have lower rates because the TGA balance is high versus higher rates if the balance was low and the Fed, I mean, and the Treasury needed to, you know, issue more treasuries to build that balance back up to where they're more comfortable. It's interesting, Sam, to like, we're not close to a debt ceiling. I think it got pushed out to, I think, September or later this year. And so it's kind of interesting that the Treasury balance is so high today when, you know, you were looking at, you did mention that the average kind of from the financial crisis to the pandemic was like $150 billion, where, you know, $700 billion, $770 billion. It seems like that's pretty high. And I was wondering, I didn't really come up with or didn't see any kind of rationale for why it was so high, especially going into the tax day. Not the tax holiday there. But, you know, I think that overall, just because it's high, that it gives you a little bit less of a pressure for the Treasury to sell more treasuries and should keep rates, you know, much more stable than they otherwise would be. And if you remember back in, I think it was the beginning of November, and really it was the Treasury refunding announcement where they were going to say they were going to issue more T-bills, less long-term treasuries. That was really the catalyst for the big move down in interest rates before Jay Powell spoke. And so some people, because this happens the same day, are like, oh, there's a big rally in interest rates. It must be something Powell said that day. That was the Powell pivot, or Powell second pivot, happened that same day, but market really rallied ahead of that Treasury refunding announcement. So if the TGA is higher, then maybe the next Treasury refunding announcement that I think we get later this month, maybe that should be a much more, or should also be positive for the bond market and positive for interest rates.
Yeah, it was interesting too. I mean, I remember that November press conference too, because that was the one where Powell came out and said that you know, the financial conditions being so tight were doing much of the Fed's work for them, you know, around that time, because that was right around the time that the 10-year got to about 5%, just under 5% in yield there. So, and on that day that the press conference happened, as you mentioned, the QRA came out, you know, a few hours before, and kind of triggered a downward move in yields that lasted for the course of the rest of 2024. So that was pretty interesting. That always stuck out in my mind. But for listeners who are kind of scratching their heads here, trying to figure out what the QRA, because, you know, we do in the world of finance and the things that we pay attention to, there are a lot of acronyms, the alphabet soup, as we like to call it. So the QRA is, you know, Jeff talked about and mentioned, is the quarterly refunding announcement. I think that is one good way of thinking about how, you know, rates might behave, as well as it is a indication on a quarterly basis that that gives points to the funding needs of the Treasury and how much they're going to have to issue. So with that in mind, Jeff and I had recorded an episode of Minutes back in February 9th of 2024, where we spent an episode talking about the Treasury quarterly funding announcements and how it could impact the path of rates moving forward, just based on expectations of funding needs from the Treasury. But again, that was episode 152. And one other episode that might be helpful for our listeners as well is just to kind of get on the other side of that supply picture of kind of the demand appetite. On episode 31, recorded on September 3rd of 2021, Jeff and I talked about Treasury auctions there and ways to make sense of that, how various participants' risk or appetite for U.S. Treasuries at various auctions across the tenors as they happen periodically. So listeners can go back there to get kind of more of a full understanding on what might, you know, some other inputs into what expectations could be for rates.
Yeah, I remember that treasury option one was interesting. At least to me, it's not something we cover or we think about too often.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, let's go to things to keep an eye on for next week. It is inflation week, so nothing going on Monday, Tuesday, but Wednesday we do get the CPI numbers. The CPI month over month headline is expected to be 0.3% versus 0.4% last month. Also, same with core, 0.3 versus 0.4 last month. That would bring headline CPI to 3.5, up from 3.2 last month. So that trend's not good for the Fed. But core CPI actually coming down from 3.8 to 3.7. So still elevated, but at least that maybe they would feel that that's coming in the right direction. We'll have to see how the various components of CPI play out and whether we can glean any information from that. We do get the Fed meeting minutes also on Wednesday, so we can see what they were talking about, really what they think. We want to hear what they were talking about at the meeting. Thursday, we do get PPI, the final demand number month over month, expected to be 0.3%. Down from 0.6% last month. The ex-food and energy PPI at 0.2, down from 0.3 last month. The year-over-year numbers were 1.6 and 2.0. So they're, PPI tends to be much more volatile than CPI. So we'll see what the trend is on those. Thursday, we also get, as typical, jobless claims numbers. Those are expected to be pretty flat from where they are today or where they were yesterday. And then on Friday, something that the Fed has talked about or in the past, not wanting to get the inflation expectations unanchored. We do get the University of Michigan 5-10 year inflation expectations. This is the April preliminary number. Last month it was 2.8. So we'll see whether that sticks around at 2.8 or maybe the increase in oil prices that we've seen here over the past couple of weeks pushes people's inflation expectations a little bit higher.
Yeah, you got to imagine next week you're going to have a number of the Federal Reserve governor is sitting there waiting for this inflation data with bated breath, because the CPI and the PPI for the prior month were the ones that kind of kicked off the surprises, relative to expectations to the upside. So after that, I believe the week following we'll have the import and export as well. So those in the previous period were also came in stronger than expectations. So it'll be interesting to see how the Fed statements come out after these reports.
Right. And as the Fed's data dependent, this data matters. So that's why we look at it, right?
That's right.
All right. I guess that's it. I guess that wraps it up for this week, Sam. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for checking us out today on Double Line Minutes. For our listeners, both on listening live on the Spaces or catching the replay, either there or on our podcast platform. Don't forget, you can also, find us on all your favorite platforms. If you're not finding anything, if you're not finding our podcast where you generally like to subscribe, then shoot us an email at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can hit us up on the X at DLine Minutes. Please also send in your questions. And as you saw today, we'll try to get to them as quickly as we can for a future topic of the week.
Yep. And don't forget, websites, doubleline.com, YouTube channel, youtube.com/doubleline capital. We also have our most recent blog post out there on the LinkedIn. And I know given it was a quiet week in macro, everyone was kind of waiting for the jobs numbers today. Not too much new content out there from us, but look forward to more content here very soon. So thanks everyone for tuning in, and hope everyone has a great weekend.
Yeah. Thanks everyone. And good luck out there. And don't forget not to stare at the sun directly. For the next week's eclipse.
Yes, wear the special glasses, especially talking to you, Cambro.
This presentation was recorded on the date indicated. Views and opinions expressed herein are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the views of Double Line Capital LP, its affiliates, or employees, should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities, and are subject to change without notice. Double Line has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. The presentation represents Double Line's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media, in any form, without the express written permission of Double Line. Double Line has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from Double Line, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither Double Line nor any of its affiliates makes any representations or warranties regarding the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this material. Liability, including any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is explicitly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice. The receipt of this presentation by any listener should not be construed as the provision of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual, nor does it imply that such person becomes a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but it does not imply low risk. Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.